Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. When Donald Trump delivered his inauguration speech in January of 2017, he made apocalyptic references to the condition of our cities.
The crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Tim Alberta, Politico Magazine's chief political correspondent, adopted part of that description for the title of his new book on the war within the Republican Party. That book, American Carnage, tells the story of how the party known for embracing aristocrats and clubby insiders morphed into Trump's populist, nativist brand of Republicanism. Here's how Tim Alberta describes what happened within the Republican Party. The revolt was near. Not everyone could see it, and not all those who did took it seriously. Trump saw it. He took it seriously. And he became its voice as the unlikeliest of insurgents, the commercial tycoon who cheated the little guy, who employed illegal workers, who made his products overseas, and who enhanced his fortune through scams and fixers and lawsuits, railing against a shredded social contract from the gilded penthouse of his Manhattan skyscraper. Tim Alberta, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you for having me.
Over the course of 600 pages or so, you make the case that Trump took advantage of forces already in play. Let's begin with how much the tenor of Republicanism has changed. I want to start with George W. Bush discussing immigration in 2006.
Illegal immigration puts pressure on public schools and hospitals. It strains state and local budgets and brings crime to our communities. These are real problems. Yet we must remember that the vast majority of illegal immigrants are decent people who work hard, support their families, practice their faith, and lead responsible lives. They are a part of American life, but they are beyond the reach and protection of American law. We're a nation of laws, and we must enforce our laws. We're also a nation of immigrants, and we must uphold that tradition which has strengthened our country in so many ways. These are not contradictory goals. America can be a lawful society and a welcoming society at the same time.
And here's what President Trump's rally last week in North Carolina sounded like as the crowd reacted to Trump criticizing Somali-American Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Tim Alberta, how did we go from here to there or there to here?
Boy, that Bush soundbite seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it? You know, there are a few things, I think, that have to be considered as part of the whole here. Obviously, there has been a tremendous amount of political polarization in this country for the last 15 to 20 years, and it's accelerated, I think, over the past decade. You've also had an enormous amount of socioeconomic displacement, millions of jobs lost across the country, particularly hard hit in middle America, in the manufacturing hubs. And then on top of that, you do have a real sense of cultural unease, and a sense among certainly many conservative voters as they look around at the country, both its complexion and its morals, that this is no longer a country that they recognize, that America circa 2019 looks and acts nothing like the America of their youth. And you add on top of that the changing media environment, the self-selection into ideological tribes where you are consuming information based on your predisposed worldview. That is a recipe for the rise of Trump. When you begin to layer those things on top of one another, what you're going to end up with is sort of a political powder keg. And so we shouldn't be surprised, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, that it exploded. And you know, all of what we saw just specifically in the political context, and even more specifically within the Republican Party over this 10-year period, from the collapse of George W. Bush's Republican Party, the sort of populist anger of the Tea Party that took the GOP by storm, the loss of Mitt Romney, who was another one of these sort of country club Republicans who could not relate to or channel the indignation of the working class, you know, the collapse of the comprehensive immigration reform pursuit in 2013 and the government shutdown just a couple of months later over Obamacare, you know, Eric Cantor being run out of town, John Boehner being run out of town. All of this was building towards something, and we didn't know that something was going to be Donald Trump. But having covered all of that I was just describing, it was very clear to me that there was a wave that was beginning to crest, and the only question was who was going to ride it. And of course, Trump came along at exactly the right time to exploit all of those conditions, and they brought him into office.
American Carnage demonstrates again and again the links Republicans are willing to go to in order to avoid the president's wrath. And one of the many examples more recently is North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, who criticized Trump's emergency declaration, and then he reversed his stance. Let's listen to what Tillis told Fox News last week when asked about the send her back chant that we just played.
Well, look, anytime you get into a crowd like that, you've got a lot of supporters, they're going to say what they want to say.
Do these types of explanations resonate with voters, you think?
Look, I don't know that Tom Tillis's explanation of, you know, what went on at that rally and his, you know, his rationale for it, his justification of it, matters nearly as much as Trump not backing down from it. Because the base in the party today is not responding to Tom Tillis. They're not responding to their congressman. At the end of the day, this is Donald Trump's party. He sets the tone from the top. Now, if Tom Tillis had come out and had criticized some of those people in the rally, or if he had taken it a step further and had been even more bold in criticizing the president himself, speaking out against his tweets about these congresswomen, then that becomes a story, because Tillis, like almost every other Republican on Capitol Hill, is terrified of Donald Trump, terrified of his base. They understand that Trump is much more popular with their constituents than they are. And if you are a member of Congress, self-preservation is sort of your guiding principle. You are not going to cross Donald Trump. You understand, having watched Jeff Flake and Mark Sanford, any number of these guys fall by the wayside. Justin Amash, who of course recently left the Republican Party after coming out against Donald Trump and calling for impeachment. There is a whole body of evidence to support the notion that this is Donald Trump's party and that anybody who dissents from him is going to be out of the party. And so Tom Tillis, like most of these other folks on Capitol Hill, they're going to play it very safe. They're going to excuse and enable all of the president's rhetoric, all of the president's behavior. And of course, what makes it especially jarring is that if you were to sit down with Tom Tillis privately, off the record, and have a drink with him or have a meal with him, he would tell you something very different about his feelings toward the president.
How is this era with Trump and the Republicans different from, say, the first George Bush battling with Ronald Reagan and talking about voodoo economics and then becoming his vice president, or Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton clashing in 2008 and then she's part of his team of rivals?
Well, I think you're always going to have significant differences in a party primary, whether that's at the local level for, you know, a state house position or for a congressional seat, and certainly for the presidency of the United States. The stakes are so high. There is so much time and emotion and blood, sweat, and tears poured into these races that, of course, you're always going to see these rivalries begin to consume the candidates. And there is a, you know, much more than just a policy dimension to that. There is a real personal, animus that can develop between some of these people. That is not new or unusual. You're right. What makes Trump and his situation, I think, singular is that Donald Trump wasn't just criticized for his policies. He wasn't just attacked in isolation on a few, in a few different episodes for certain things he had done or said. Donald Trump was called a pathological liar by Ted Cruz, the runner-up for the presidential nomination. Marco Rubio called him a con man and joked about the size of his genitals. Rick Perry, who's now a member of the cabinet, called Donald Trump a cancer on conservatism. Lindsey Graham, who is arguably Trump's closest ally in Capitol Hill, called him a race-baiting, xenophobic bigot, I believe was his exact phrase. It's not just that they were hoping to defeat Donald Trump. It's that they were sounding the alarms about Donald Trump, trying to impress upon Republican voters that this is someone who is fundamentally unsuited to hold the highest office in the land. But once he won the election, all of them reached essentially the same conclusion, which is that if I want to preserve my career, if I want to have any influence over this person, then I have to shut up. I have to bite my tongue. I can no longer be out there criticizing him in the way that I was. And look, I think even beyond that, I should point out many politicians in Washington view Congress and view the federal government as sort of a zero-sum proposition. If you are doing anything to criticize the Republican Party and its leader, then you are inherently helping the Democratic Party. And that sort of zero-sum mentality is a big reason why, that tribal mentality is a big, big reason why most of these Republicans simply refuse to come out and criticize Trump publicly, even when privately they will tear him to shreds.
Let me ask you about Trump in terms of this state. He won North Carolina by 4 points in 2016. Republicans are bringing their convention to Charlotte next summer. As best we can tell, no one else, with the possible exception of Las Vegas, wanted any part of this convention. Why not? What's the risk as cities were looking at this, do you think?
I'm not terribly sure what the risk is. Frankly, you know, I've gone to a number of political conventions and, national nominating conventions, and you always have protests. You always have an enormous amount of security. So I don't know whether some of these cities felt like they just didn't want to be associated with Trump, or if it was going to be a black eye for the business community or whatever it may be. But it's all, frankly, I think a little bit silly. You know, Mitt Romney was, in retrospect, of course, placed in the context of where we are today, Mitt Romney is about the least threatening human being to ever be nominated for president. And there were huge protests in Tampa in 2012. People showing up saying that Romney was going to, like, you know, throw grandmothers out in the street to starve to death. Right. So, like, I don't know. For my money, I think it's a little bit goofy. But obviously, Republicans did not want to have the convention in Las Vegas because Lord knows what kind of trouble Republican delegates might be getting themselves into out there.
To your point about cities being nervous, I want to play you a quick clip of a response this week from a Charlotte City Councilman. He's one of two Republicans talking about why the convention should stay in place.
I don't personally endorse the way the president has chose to express himself on this occasion and others. I think those of you who know me realize that I'm kind of in the mold of a Reagan Republican. I don't conduct myself this way. I wouldn't want to be measured by that behavior. I do believe the president has pursued policies that will benefit our country, which is why I continue to support him in spite of my disagreement with some of his utterances, I guess I'll call it.
How does that compare with the sentiment you hear from Republicans around the country?
Well, there are some Republicans who will, I think, very carefully try to draw that distinction when they're speaking publicly. At the risk of repeating myself here, but I think it's very important, there is a huge gulf between how Republicans will talk about Donald Trump in private and how they will talk about him in public. Having covered Washington, having covered Congress for a long time, and knowing a lot of these people very well on the Republican side of the aisle, I can't put it any more plainly that when you go out and have a drink with one of these folks, or you step into their office and you just have a quick, 10-minute conversation about something and you're off the record, they will give you chapter on verse on how uncomfortable Trump makes them, how disgusted they may be by his rhetoric, but they do not have the courage to come out and say it in public. And so I think even listening to that city councilman, that's even farther, I think, than most Republican elected officials are willing to go, because he's at least acknowledging as preface that, yes, I am uncomfortable with some of this. This is not how I conduct myself, but, X, Y, and Z. I think that's even a step further than most Republican elected officials are willing to go these days.
That's Tim Alberta. We're going to go several steps further when we come back. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Tim Alberta. He is the chief political correspondent at Politico magazine, and he is the author of American Carnage, a book that takes a comprehensive look at how Donald Trump rose to the top of the Republican Party. Tim, before we get back to the Republicans, I want to ask you a little bit about the Democrats. Your book does such a terrific job of showing how insincere and craven so many of these party leaders and congressmen are when it comes to Trump, and you just outlined some of the reasons why. Have you thought about taking a similar approach in reporting on the Democrats at some point?
You know, I've been asked that a few times, and I'm certainly beginning to take some notes and watch pretty carefully what's happening over there, because there are some parallels, no question. I don't know that what you're seeing happen on the Democratic side is totally analogous to what happened, at this point 8 to 10 years ago on the Republican side. I think, you know, the seeds have been planted in a way that, you know, they could be harvested quite similarly down the road. But I think what's important to recognize is that Trump in many ways sort of laid a blueprint for the Democratic Party. And it's not necessarily a bad blueprint. Let me explain what I mean by that. There is, I think, a temptation to view Trump and Trumpism as a cautionary tale for the Democrats. Like, look what happened to the Republican Party. You know, that you don't want to follow down this path. You don't want to repeat the mistakes that were made by the Republicans who allowed this demagogue to come and take over their party. But the fact of the matter is, at least as a matter of policy, Donald Trump has achieved an enormous amount for the Republican Party, arguably more for the party than anybody since Reagan. And he did so in part because he was unconventional, because he was unwilling to bow to political conventions, because he was constantly, you know, attacking the left and unwilling to back down from any kind of a fight. And so on the one hand, sure, you could view it as a cautionary tale, because I think for many Americans, regardless of political persuasion, they understand that this is not good for the country on the whole, that this period of intense animosity between the parties and this really visceral sort of ad hominem political environment that we're living in is not a healthy one. So I think people recognize that. But on the other hand, if you are a liberal and you believe that even the Obama presidency did not go far enough in pursuing some of your ideals, whether it be on healthcare and a much more progressive healthcare policy, whether it be on, you know, ceasing the deportation of illegal immigrants, up and down the list, there are a lot of progressives who feel like Barack Obama let them down in some way, that he did not push hard enough, that he did not fight hard enough for their viewpoints, for their way of life. And so I do wonder if Democrats are sort of very carefully watching Trump and some of the asymmetrical warfare on the right that produced him, and if they are actively engaging now in that asymmetrical warfare on the left, believing that it will not only pull the party farther toward the base, but that it will eventually produce a presidential nominee who is somewhat in the mold of Trump, of basically stepping into the arena and being willing to go to war in a way that maybe a Joe Biden or a more mainstream moderate Democratic nominee would not be willing to.
You know, it's interesting going through this book, which is covering roughly a 10-year period from the end of the George W. Bush presidency into the Trump administration, just from the sheer tonnage of blunders and missteps, and many of them, I found myself sort of slapping my forehead going, oh, I forgot about, you know, the Senate candidate who was talking about witchcraft and all these things. When you line up all those missteps, how surprising does it become that the Democrats so often failed to capitalize? You have John Boehner telling you that Barack Obama could have wiped out the party for a generation.
Yeah, you know, when you go back to the outset of the Obama administration, I think that there were a couple of tactical errors made. And this is really important part of the story, because we understand that for many Republicans in Congress, obstructionism was going to be their top priority, that they wanted to defeat Barack Obama, make him a one-term president. Mitch McConnell said as much. And so, yes, as a baseline for everything I'm about to say, it is important to recognize that there were lots of Republicans who were going to be obstructionists no matter what. That being said, there were also more than a few Republicans in Congress at that time who were absolutely terrified of Barack Obama. This is a guy who had just won a landslide election in 2008. He's coming into Washington with a 70% approval rating, and he has supermajorities in both parties. And you've got dozens of House Republicans who represent districts that were just carried by Obama in November of 2008, and they are really, really quite terrified of him and daunted at the prospect of him sort of mowing them down and his Democratic Party being so strong at that point and their Republican Party being so weakened by the end of the Bush presidency. And so in that context, for example, when they went to craft the stimulus bill, which was the first big legislative push out of the gates, I think there were some real fundamental missteps by Obama and by his team in essentially listening to Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and some of the top Democrats on Capitol Hill who said to Obama, look, these Republicans, you know, they just spent the entire Bush presidency running over us and never soliciting our input. Capitol Hill had been a very nasty place, especially during the final 4 years of Bush's presidency. And Pelosi and Reid, they came to Obama, you know, just as he was sworn in, and they said, don't waste your time playing footsies with these people. Most of them are never going to come along anyway. Let's just write our bill and we'll pass it. And I think, obviously, when power changes hands between parties, there is always an inclination to say, you know, screw these people. We don't need them. We don't need their input. Let's just do what we want to do. The problem is that Obama had run as a post-partisan figure and that he had promised to bring these parties back together, and that specifically on the stimulus package in January of 2009, keep in mind, unemployment is soaring up into the teens across the country. Obama meets with Republicans before he's sworn in, and he tells them, look, this is a national emergency. This is not a Republican emergency, a Democratic emergency. I want to get our best ideas together, and we are going to put a package on the floor in the House and in the Senate that addresses all of our concerns. And Republicans felt really encouraged by that he was very sincere. But if suddenly, a few days later, after he is sworn in, Nancy Pelosi already has a bill written. And you know, the short story of all of this is that the bill winds up passing the House without a single Republican vote just 8 days after Obama was sworn in. And that is absolutely remarkable because, again, yes, there were plenty of Republicans who may have never been willing to vote for that bill, but there were plenty that were. There were plenty of Republicans at that point who believed that Obama was sincere in wanting to produce a bipartisan product to give a real shot in the arm to the economy, lots of tax cuts, lots of infrastructure spending, you know, funding to state governments. That is what they were expecting. And instead, Democrats wound up rushing through a bill that was sort of hastily put together. It was not a great legislative product. It did not have any buy-in from Republicans. And what that did was not only did it sort of shatter the mystique of Obama as a postpartisan guy who wanted Republicans to work with him closely, but it also kept Republicans' fingerprints off of the economic recovery. They were then allowed to say for the next 6 years, hey, this is Obama's economy. This guy went it alone. He did not take any of our advice. He did not work with us on this bill. Therefore, this is his economy now. And I think that wound up obviously being quite damaging to the Democratic Party.
And the key word there that you write about in the book is infrastructure, the fact that you didn't have bridges and roads and projects that would naturally be supported on a bipartisan basis as the heart of the bill. Those are the words of Tim Alberta. He is the author of American Carnage. Tim, I want to ask you about, there are so many connections to the Carolinas, both in your book and in the Republicans' recent history. One of the most interesting thumbnail sketches you include is the rise of Mark Meadows, who is the head of the Freedom Caucus in Congress and a self-described misfit, fat kid. How did he become a player in Washington, and how does his relationship with Trump fit with Mark Meadows' core beliefs?
Meadows is a fascinating guy, and he is nothing if not an opportunist. And I don't even say that, in a negative way necessarily, but this is somebody who is politically very, very adroit, very agile, somebody who understands which way the winds are blowing and how to get out in front of them. Meadows, when he came to Congress, was this sort of button-down, you know, country club Republican. And it's not to say that he was a moderate without any conservative principles. That's not the point. But temperamentally, Meadows didn't strike anybody as a bomb thrower. Meadows was a pretty accommodating guy who everybody seemed to get along with. He's, you know, kind of slapping everybody on the back. He's got this sweet tea accent. Nobody had anything negative to say about Mark Meadows. And in fact, when he first came, I spent a lot of mornings with Mark Meadows. We had a number of breakfasts while he was a freshman lawmaker, and I was just getting to know him. I do this with a lot of freshmen, and he was a really interesting guy because I could tell from the first time we met that he was very much interested in media and how to get his name in the media and how to be a part of the story in Washington. Well, fast forward, later in 2013, his first year in Congress, he winds up becoming a key player in that government shutdown in the fall of 2013 because he wrote a letter to the House Republican leadership and got signatures from dozens of House Republicans demanding, basically taking a hardline stance against any bill that would fund the government and also fund the new Affordable Care Act program that was being implemented that fall that had been, of course, passed a few years earlier. And that example alone was, I think, really worth examining in the book because it's so unusual for a freshman member of Congress, and we're seeing it now with AOC and some of these folks on the left, but, for generations, you just never heard of a freshman member of Congress agitating in this way and sort of provoking their party's leadership. And Meadows was a very unlikely character to do so, but suddenly he is a national name. He is being championed by a lot of these Tea Party groups. He's on television, and I'm watching him very carefully. And sure enough, then in 2014, he's making more moves. He's beginning to sort of take the helm along with Jim Jordan and a couple of others of this group, and they're not yet the Freedom Caucus, but there's this group of sort of rebel conservatives, and they are really making life miserable on the leadership in their party. And of course, you fast forward to 2015, Meadows helps to form the Freedom Caucus, and then he files the motion to vacate this parliamentary procedure that essentially winds up leading to the ouster of John Boehner as Speaker of the House. And you track all of these things, you connect the dots between all these events with Mark Meadows, and you can see that this is a very shrewd, very ambitious guy who clearly sees himself as a player. What's so interesting is that as Trump is ascending in the Republican Party in late 2015, early 2016, Meadows privately is telling people that this guy is a joke, that this guy is not a conservative, that he doesn't share any of their values, that they should be working against him. Meadows endorses Ted Cruz in that primary. And in fact, once Trump had won the nomination, Meadows told his friends privately, as I report in the book, that he didn't want to go to the convention in Cleveland because Meadows was a delegate at the convention and he was worried about having to cast a vote for Donald Trump and how history might remember him for casting a vote at the convention in favor of nominating Trump as the GOP standard bearer. Of course, we know today that Meadows has become one of Trump's closest allies and that he is on the phone with the president sometimes two or three times in a day. And Meadows stays so close to the president that it actually is a source of tension in the West Wing because he shows up uninvited and nobody knows why the heck Mark Meadows is even there half the time. His proximity to power and his capacity for sort of shape-shifting and seizing opportunity and making the most of it politically is really a source of fascination in Washington. And he is a character who I think looms large in this story and who is going to be very much worth watching in the years to come because once Trump is gone, does Meadows begin to sort of reinvent himself a second or a third time? He is really an enigma to a lot of people on Capitol Hill for some of the reasons I was just mentioning. And I don't think anybody has ever had a great read on Meadows, but I do try to dig deep into him in the book because I think to understand him is to understand much of what's happened in the Republican Party.
Well, and going back to this idea, and look, we all know that politics is a blood sport, but the sheer audacity of Mark Meadows when he's a freshman, he's part of a group that wants to run John Boehner out. It takes them a couple of attempts before they do. But then when Boehner gets wind of this, as you recount it, Mark Meadows goes to John Boehner's office and falls to his knees and begs for forgiveness, literally.
Literally falls to his knees and puts his hands in front of his chest and begs for forgiveness. And this is a story that had circulated a little bit as maybe a rumor for some years on Capitol Hill. And then not only did John Boehner tell me the story himself, confirming all of the details, but I talked to two people who were in the room who also confirmed it. And One of them said to me, this was the strangest behavior I had ever seen in Congress. You don't expect this kind of thing. And knowing Meadows a little bit and having spent some time with him over the years, let me just say, put it this way, I can definitely see it happening. I can visualize it in my mind. Look, Meadows is a guy who's not real comfortable with confrontation, believe it or not. This is somebody who is very polite, very winsome. When Donald Trump sort of went after Mark Meadows by name in the spring of 2017, when Republicans were trying to pass their health care reform package, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, Meadows was a holdout, and Meadows was desperate to get to yes, but Meadows also understood that he had a lot of the conservatives in the Freedom Caucus who were watching him very carefully because they worried that he was too close to the president, that he didn't have the backbone to stand up to the president. So Meadows was sort of backed into a corner, and he announced his opposition to the bill. And Trump came after him in a private meeting of the entire House Republican conference. They're meeting with President Trump, and Trump calls him out by name and basically tries to intimidate him and says, oh, don't worry about Mark. Mark will come along. And that was a real turning point for Meadows, because never again would he dare to defy the president. That was a moment where people around Meadows realized that Mark just did not have the stomach for one of these really nasty knockdown, drag out policy disagreements with the president, much less a personal disagreement with the president. And so ever since then, he has been in Trump's corner unfailingly.
So there's another Carolina's connection in terms of being in Trump's corner, and that's Mick Mulvaney, who grew up in Charlotte and represented a congressional district just across the state line in South Carolina. You describe him in the book as, quote, a mouthy, whip-smart fiscal hawk whose distrust of then-Speaker Boehner was surpassed only by a skepticism of the right's sincerity in avoiding fiscal ruin, end quote. So how did that Mick Mulvaney morph into the Mick Mulvaney who now says, we are not going to cut our way to balance the budget?
You know, Mulvaney is yet another one who, I mentioned some of these folks earlier, who had been sharply critical of Donald Trump during his political rise, who have now cozied up to him and are in positions of great influence and authority. You know, I covered Mulvaney since he came to Washington in 2010. I've spent lots of time with him over the years. We've had lots of long conversations. Mulvaney is a guy who, I guess I'm surprised by him more than many others, because Mulvaney really did always strike me as incredibly convicted of his beliefs. And it's not to say that he is any less convicted now, but he's certainly much more politically malleable now than he once was. Mulvaney is a guy who, you know, you may recall, as he was going through confirmation hearings to become Trump's OMB director, he was grilled by John McCain about all of his votes against defense spending. And that's not easy to do coming from a state like South Carolina, as you guys know well. Mulvaney was such a fiscal hawk that he was usually voting with Democrats and with progressive Democrats against increases in defense spending, because Mulvaney just thought that it was not appropriate. And so for Mulvaney, and that's just on the policy front, by the way. You know, personality-wise, Mulvaney had called Trump a terrible human being and talked at length to me about how they were sort of afraid that Trump might try to shred the Constitution. So Mulvaney has obviously gone through quite an evolution himself.
Tim, let's take a break. I want to come back and continue with more on Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, and more from American Carnage. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Tim Alberta. He is the chief political correspondent at Politico Magazine. He is also the author of the new book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. I cut you off a little bit there at the break. I apologize, but you were explaining a little bit of the metamorphosis of Mick Mulvaney, the deficit hawk, into the current chief of staff who's a little less wound up about debt and deficits.
Yes, and look, to his credit, Mulvaney has been agitating inside the administration and enlisting some of his allies on the outside, in the think tank world, in the advocacy world, to try and put pressure on the White House to cut spending, and even to begin exploring, you know, how to tinker with entitlements, something that, you know, President Trump has insisted he would not do. He would not touch Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. So Mulvaney, I don't think, is any less of a true believer in his heart of hearts about the fiscal course that the country is on and that it's unsustainable and that something has to happen. But I think Mulvaney, like so many of these other folks, be it Paul Ryan, be it Mitch McConnell, you go to up and down the list, Mulvaney has decided that it is better to stay on the inside and retain his influence over the president and keep this position of enormous authority so that he can help to steer the ship rather than come out and sort of go to war openly, publicly with the president and lose any of that authority. I think there's a combination of things here at work. Obviously, there is raw ambition, and for guys like Meadows and Mulvaney and many others, these are folks who have spent the last 10 or 20 years dreaming of being in a position where they can have this sort of influence over the president of the United States of America and help to shape his policy directives and shape, you know, his direction for taking the country. I also think it's important to recognize that there are a lot of people who worry that President Trump is unsteady, that he doesn't know what he's doing, and that if he was not surrounded by good people, then a bad situation would be made much, much worse. And Mulvaney would never say that publicly, but I can guarantee you that privately, that is a huge motivating factor for him, where he feels like he has to swallow his criticisms of the president, he has to go along with the president on certain things that he otherwise would never be willing to go along with, in order to stay in Trump's orbit, to keep that influence that he has, to help try to put up some guardrails around the president, as it were. And look, he is not always successful. I think he's even less successful than somebody like John Kelly was for a stretch of time. Trump, I don't think, has this deep, abiding respect for Mulvaney. I think that they have a decent working relationship, and Trump thinks that Mulvaney's a smart guy who has good relationships and that he's capable. But Trump doesn't fear Mulvaney. And so, you know, the chief of staff office in this White House is almost meaningless. We've seen that with Priebus and with John Kelly and now with Mick Mulvaney. They are essentially, in many cases, delegated to the role of, you know, executive assistant, much more so than chief of staff, because traditionally a chief of staff runs the West Wing, and nobody can run the West Wing when Donald Trump sort of refuses to follow any sort of a schedule, when he is completely undisciplined with his messaging. It's a thankless job, and frankly, it's a job that I don't think Mulvaney is going to hold on to for very much longer.
Is part of the calculus here, Tim, that when you talk about people like Meadows and Mulvaney and others who are coming into Trump's orbit and perhaps oppose not only his tactics and words, but his policies, is part of the calculus that people's memories are so short that by the time this becomes a sour memory within the Republican base, they can move on to something else and won't be tainted by it?
I think that's probably part of it. And I think that's a really, really poor calculation for a lot of these folks, because we are living through an era right now, politically and otherwise, that will not soon be forgotten. And when you talk with some of these Republicans privately, they will tell you that they worry that they will all wear this scarlet letter from Trumpism for a very long time, that the party will not just have this sort of neat, clean turning of the page, whether it be in a couple of years or in 6 years if he were to win a second term. Donald Trump is going to loom large over the Republican Party for a generation to come, if not even longer. And I think it's going to be awfully difficult for some of these Republicans who were adamantly opposed to him a couple of years ago, who are now fierce defenders and allies of his today, to then take the next logical step in their evolutions in a few years, which is to sort of distance themselves from Trump and say, well, you know, I think we got a lot done for the country, but I wasn't real comfortable with X, Y, and Z. I think that's going to be a really difficult maneuver for most of these folks to pull off.
I want to ask you about Nikki Haley. She was the governor of South Carolina. She became Trump's UN ambassador for a time. I want to begin by playing you a clip from 2016. This is right after Nikki Haley has delivered the Republican response to the State of the Union address. She made some remarks alluding to Donald Trump. And she goes on the Today Show, and here is what Matt Lauer asks her about that speech.
I just want to be clear here that when you were talking about those loudest voices, those angriest voices, in that context, you were referring to Donald Trump, correct?
He was one of them, yes. He was one. There's other people in the media. There's people in my state. I think we're seeing it across the country. But yes, Mr. Trump has definitely contributed to what I think is just irresponsible talk.
So I want to ask you two things about this. The first is something that's been a theme throughout this show and your book, which is, again, how do you go from that to becoming the UN ambassador? But secondarily, you include an anecdote in the book where then Lieutenant Governor Henry McMaster, who of course is now South Carolina's governor, and Trump are talking, and McMaster says the only thing he wants to be is governor, and Trump says something like, "Really? Is that all you want?" And then soon enough, Nikki Haley is UN ambassador. So tie all those things together for me.
So Trump did not have any relationship with Nikki Haley during the campaign, and what little he knew of Nikki Haley, he knew was her criticisms of him, both during his ascent in that soundbite you played. Also, once she endorsed Marco Rubio for president, she came out and was pretty critical of Trump on a handful of occasions, and made clear that as an immigrant and as a child of immigrants, that she found his rhetoric to be offensive and contrary to the American creed. So when Nikki Haley was appointed UN ambassador, it was awfully surprising to a lot of people, including some people in her orbit who didn't think that, you know, she would want that job. But Trump offered it in order to help his friend Henry McMaster become the governor of South Carolina, and Haley took it. Now, Haley, I think, is in a slightly different position than a lot of these folks in the administration who are with Trump, you know, almost every day, who are in Washington. Nikki Haley's in New York, so she's got some separation from Trump, you know, geographically and otherwise. And she, on any number of occasions, I think, went a step further in establishing that daylight from the administration during speeches at the UN, during media interviews. Haley was really careful to modulate her messaging, and she's very talented. And look, make no mistake about it, Nikki Haley wants to be president one day. And everything that she has done and is continuing to do now in terms of meeting with donors, in terms of releasing a book this fall, Nikki Haley, more than anybody, I would argue, more than Rubio, more than Cruz, more than Tom Cotton, any of these other folks who have their eye on the post-Trump Republican Party in 2024, these are folks who are beginning to position themselves and jockey a little bit behind the scenes to figure out how to marry some of Trump's populist appeal to the working class base that had been sour on the Republican Party for decades, how to marry that with a much broader message capable of appealing to a far larger swath of the American electorate. And Haley, I think, has been working on that harder than anyone. And I think she's obviously banking on the idea that, you know, that scarlet letter I described a minute ago, that she may wear it to a degree, but that it won't be stamped like firmly on her forehead the way that it is with some of these other Republicans in Washington. At least that's what she's banking on.
It sounds like you're pretty crystal clear on the fact that Nikki Haley was offered that job in part to help Henry McMaster become governor.
Yes, there's no question about it. I have very good sources on that story, and there was no denial from anybody involved.
We discussed earlier Tom Tillis and the reversal on the stance with the emergency declaration and the wall funding, and you later mentioned Lindsey Graham, and I'm sort of saving, I guess, the best for last when it comes to one of the most confounding flip-flops in terms of how someone views this president. Let's start by listening to Lindsey Graham describing then-candidate Trump in 2015.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party. He doesn't represent the values that the men and women who wear the uniform are fighting for. And you know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
And this is Senator Lindsey Graham in 2019 talking about President Trump.
I want him to be successful, and I've come to know the guy, and I really do believe that if you're a Somali refugee who likes Trump, he's not going to say go back to Somalia. A racist says go back to Somalia because you're Somalian or you're Muslim or whatever. That's just the way he is. It's more narcissism than anything else.
So, Tim Alberta, I know, or I think I know, this is a topic of conversation in Washington, but I don't think it will surprise you that this is a little bit of an obsession in the Carolinas, is people a lot of times are just trying to figure out how did Lindsey Graham make such a dramatic swing from one viewpoint to another. What do you make of this beyond the raw political calculation of being on the ballot in 2020?
So I think it's two things. And as I said earlier, I don't want to repeat myself, but I don't want to overthink this either, because politicians are pretty simple people, believe it or not. I mean, they orient their careers around self-preservation, so they want to hang on to their jobs, right? So that's one part of this. Yes, Lindsey Graham is on the ballot in 2020. He's had Republican primary challenges in the past. He has always been a pretty moderate Republican, so he has always been somewhat vulnerable to his right flank. There is no better way to shore up your right flank in today's Republican Party than to be buddy-buddy with Donald Trump, and Graham realizes that. He's a very astute politician. I think the second part of it is that when a lot of these Republicans talk about wanting to have influence over Trump and help to steer the ship internally, Graham can make a case that he's probably done that better than anybody. Lindsey Graham is constantly on the phone with Donald Trump. He's constantly over at the White House. He's constantly playing golf with the president. And Lindsey Graham does exert a great deal of influence over the president's decision making, especially as it pertains to matters of foreign policy. And so, yes, is it painful and just cringeworthy to watch somebody like Graham, who, you know, when his best friend John McCain was alive, the two of them were out there consistently criticizing Trump and his rhetoric, his behavior, his policies, calling them un-American, saying that they were doing more to help al-Qaeda than to hurt the cause of terrorism in terms of the Muslim ban and some of these other things. Is it incredible and just head-spinning to watch Lindsey Graham do this? Yes, of course it is. And people will be talking about this for years to come. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, Lindsey Graham is just another symptom of this broader illness within the Republican Party right now, which is that it's a binary proposition for all of these guys. Are you with Trump or are you against Trump? And if you want to hold on to your job, if you want to hang on to any influence that you have in Washington, you're going to answer that question in the affirmative. Yes, I am with Trump. I am unfailingly and unflinchingly with Trump. To dissent from him is to lose your career in most cases, and that's not a risk that any of these guys are willing to take.
This book is so exhaustive in its detail and in the interviews that you conducted with members of Congress and former members of Congress and presidential candidates and on and on. I'm wondering who out there was, the big whale that you couldn't get. Who did you really want to have or have on the record that you just couldn't get to do that?
I really wanted to have Sarah Palin on the record, and she would not cooperate, and she doesn't do much media at all anymore anyway, so I didn't take it personally or anything, but I do think that she would have some really interesting insights into how Donald Trump kind of picked up the torch and carried it to a place where she was unable to carry it. I think, obviously, Palin in many ways was the canary in the coal mine here, and that her ability to expose that disconnect between the Republican elite and the Republican working class, and the cult following that she developed in so doing, and the Tea Party that she in many ways helped give rise to, you know, Palin was in many ways the precursor to Trump. She foreshadowed his rise. And so I would have loved to have her talk to me about that, but unfortunately she declined an interview.
Now, I know you're a reporter and not a prognosticator, but if pressed, what do you think the chances are for re-election for this president?
Look, I think that I don't know that I'd say they're better than 50-50, but I think they're at least probably 50-50, because on the one hand, the Democratic Party is playing with fire themselves right now. When you have a debate a couple of weeks ago in Miami where they're all asked how many of you would cover undocumented immigrants with your health care plan, and every single person on stage raises their hand, it's worth recognizing that 10 years earlier, almost to the day, Barack Obama convened a joint session of Congress where he wanted to dispel some of the myths about his health care plan, starting with that one, that he was going to cover illegal immigrants. Obama was really adamant that he would not be covering undocumented immigrants with the ACA. And of course, that was the night where another Carolina guy, Joe Wilson, screamed at him, "You lie." And to have that juxtaposition from 10 years earlier to where Democrats are today, just on that issue of covering illegal immigrants, and then you take it further, you know, this idea of decriminalizing border crossings, this idea of Medicare for all and private and getting rid of private insurance for 150 million Americans. This, a lot of this is just playing right into Trump's hands because he wants to paint, Trump understands that a lot of America thinks that he's radical, that he's extreme, but he wants to pit his perceived extremism against an extremism on the other side. And Democrats are at real risk of playing right into his strategy. So obviously, I think a lot of this depends on how the Democratic primary unfolds and who their standard bearer is. Trump has a very thin margin for error. He only won the presidency in 2016 by virtue of carrying three states by a combined margin of about 78,000 votes, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. It's going to be very hard for him to hold on to those three states. So I think Trump is certainly in a decent position because of the economy being really strong and a lot of Republicans still standing by him despite some of his more alienating and incendiary behavior. But if Democrats can nominate somebody who has appeal to mainstream voters, to disaffected Republicans, to independents, then I think the president is probably going to have his hands full next November.
Let's leave it right there. Thank you, Tim Alberta, so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Tim Alberta is the author of American Carnage. You've been listening to Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.